everyone, and welcome back to Historical Friction, a podcast about retelling the past and reframing the present through pop culture and fiction. I'm Abigail, and today on the show, special guest Dr. Lisa Duffy and I discuss The Pirate, a 1948 movie musical starring Judy Garland and Gene Kelly, directed by Vincent Minnelli. This is a delightful, campy romp of a film, and our conversation today covers real-life Golden Age pirates, Hollywood pirates, mid-century Hollywood musicals, Gene Kelly's excellent short shorts, and where this film, The Pirate, fits into those categories. Just so you know, there are definitely spoilers for this 74-year-old film in our conversation. Also, a quick content warning. In our chat, we discuss racism in mid-20th century Hollywood films, and some of the character dynamics in the film feel a bit problematic in the wake of conversations surrounding the Me Too movement. As always, you can find our podcast on Twitter at History Friction, and if you like our podcast, please rate and review us. It can really help us to grow our audience. We also have a Patreon, and we've started putting out monthly digests with sneak peeks of upcoming episodes and behind-the-scenes looks at what we're working on, watching, and reading. We're always grateful for any support you can give to the podcast. Also, since basically no one has seen The Pirate, here's a brief plot summary of the film, complete with spoilers. If you've seen the movie or you don't need a summary, please feel free to skip ahead about 2 minutes to get straight into the episode. The Pirate. Judy Garland plays Manuela, a young girl living in a village on a Caribbean island. She thirsts for adventure and reads books about a famed pirate named Makoko, who she hopes will one day steal her away from her village life. Unfortunately, her dreams of traveling are dashed when her Aunt Inez betroths her to the quiet, aging mayor of the town, Don Pedro, who, in my opinion, looks a lot like current British actor Matt Berry. Don Pedro doesn't seem like a bad guy, but he's kind of boring and tells Manuela that he never plans to travel again. She goes to pick up her Parisian wedding trousseau at a nearby port city where she encounters a traveling player named Seraphin, played by Gene Kelly. Though Seraphin sings a song about how he loves all women, the second he sees Manuela, his heart is hers. Unfortunately for him, she rebuffs him. Later that night, however, Manuela attends Seraphin's show, and one of the acts in his show, and his greatest skill, apparently, is putting people into deep, legitimate hypnotic trances. So he hypnotizes Manuela, hoping she'll admit that she doesn't love her fiancé. She does admit it, but she says she loves the pirate Makoko! Cut to a week later, her wedding day. Seraphin arrives, and when he meets Don Pedro, he realizes, plot twist, Don Pedro is the pirate Makoko, but retired and in hiding, and if Don Pedro were discovered, he could be hanged for his crimes. However, Seraphin also knows that Manuela is in love with the Makoko of her dreams, so he pretends that he is Makoko to win her heart. Don Pedro, meanwhile, realizes that if everyone in town believes Seraphin is a pirate, he can have Seraphin hanged and be done with the whole Makoko business forever. Manuela is at first taken in by Seraphin's pirate act, but quickly figures out that Seraphin is faking being a pirate. Still, that doesn't stop her from falling madly in love with him. Just then, the island commissioner arrives to hang Seraphin, believing he's Makoko. With a few more hypnotic trances, some treasure chests, and Don Pedro's own ego, all is revealed. Seraphin is saved, and the movie ends with Manuela and Seraphin adventuring across the world together as traveling players. Now, on to the episode. Hi, everyone, and welcome back to Historical Friction. Today, I, Abigail, am here with Dr. Lisa Duffy, who was on our Schmigadoon episode way back in January or February. So if you want to go check that out, do. Lisa has her PhD in film studies from Queen Mary University of London. And today, we are talking about the Gene Kelly, Judy Garland 1948 film, The Pirate, which is Lisa's favorite film ever. Right behind her right now, she has two images of the pirate on her wall.
And actually one next to me as well that is out of frame that I've just realized is there. It is the pirate everywhere here.
So the pirate, it was wild. So Lisa, I want to know, why is this your favorite film?
How can you ask me this question? This is a masterpiece of cinema. I love this film because it is bonkers. It is just, from one second to another, you don't really know what's going to happen. Everyone's just having a really good time and hamming it up, and it's gorgeous and fun and just the best. It's just an enjoyable hour and a half to sit and watch a movie.
I mean, I will admit, I did enjoy it. Something that I found interesting is that I had no idea what time period this was supposed to take place.
Yes.
Typically, when we think of pirate films and Hollywood, we think of 18th century and the golden age of piracy. So the golden age of pirates was roughly 1650 to 1720. And that's the age of Blackbeard and Stede Bonnet, because I know we're both in Tar Flag Means Death right now, more pirate media. But it's, you know, Blackbeard, Black Bellamy, and these more famous pirates. Most of what I think Hollywood has trained us to see as pirates and piracy was over by 1720. But the myth of the daring, dashing, romantic pirate and the Robin Hood-esque pirate began pretty early in the history of piracy. So the original pirate, according to Colin Woodard's book, The Republic of Pirates, was Henry Avery. And Henry Avery sailed the seas, did some really crappy stuff, actually. You can read all about it. But at home, there were a lot of pamphlets published that made it seem like he was sort of a Robin Hood figure that was stealing from the rich, particularly the Spanish, and giving to the poor. And his legend only continued to grow within his lifetime. So there were pamphlets about him, there was a play about his life, and other pirates following his reign as a pirate in the late 17th century really modeled themselves on Avery in the early 18th century. And then Woodes Roger, who actually is who Defoe based Robinson Crusoe on, became governor of Nassau and the Bahamas and really cracked down on pirates and put an end to everything. But then in 1724, a pamphlet or a book came out called A General History of Pirates by Captain Charles Johnson, I think. And that book really, really molded how Robert Louis Stevenson and J.M. Barrie, in much later in the 19th and early 20th century, ended up writing their pirates in Treasure Island and in Peter Pan, which are some of our most influential pirates in pop culture today. But I know Lisa knows a lot more about the Hollywood pirate than I do. So if you want to give us some background on the Hollywood pirate.
I mean, I would not say a lot more, but within Hollywood, the pirate figure really emerges during the silent era. Kind of the big pirates movie of the time was The Black Pirate in 1926, starring Douglas Fairbanks. Massive hit. Everyone loved it. And this sort of figure of what Fairbanks is doing in this really helps establish what the Hollywood pirate is. This really dashing, swashbuckling, romantic figure. And that's sort of carried on throughout the years in all the pirate films that they make. Another big one of the time is Captain Blood in 1935, which has Errol Flynn playing a pirate. And so really, yeah, Fairbanks and Flynn are kind of the big names in pirate films in this classical era of Hollywood. They're kind of what are setting the tone for the pirate figure. They're what are being referenced in the film The Pirate, coming out in 1948. Gene Kelly bases his character of Serafin on Fairbanks's pirate from 1926. It was a film that he saw as a kid and he loved, and he always wanted to be a pirate. So that's kind of what he's channeling in this film. So that's kind of what's setting the tone in the classical Hollywood era until we get to, what is it, 1950 with Treasure Island, which then kind of makes the pirate go in a different course after that. And after that, it's all the sort of army, maybe swashbuckle, that sort of pirate.
Shiver me timbers.
Gets us, exactly. All of that is created in the 1950 film version of Treasure Island. So prior to that, we get really romantic, swashbuckling pirates. And then after that, it's all the pirates. It's really fun to mimic how they talk, but no one actually talks like that. So yeah, so we have kind of two distinct eras coming on there. But the pirate 1948 is kind of referencing all of these romantic, swashbuckling, classical Hollywood pirates.
That's interesting, too, given it's at some point in the 19th century time setting instead of the 18th century, because it does seem like all the media that I can think of is 18th century. But this one mentions that Judy Garland's wedding trousseau is coming from Paris. And when it arrives, on the box, it says House of Worth. And I'm assuming that means Charles Worth, who was a couturier, but he didn't actually open his house until 1858. So I was like, well, that means this has to be at least later. And the sleeves and the styles of the dresses look much more 19th century. I'm not a huge expert on 19th century costume, but it has more of, honestly, like an 1830s sleeve look going on. I guess you could say it's 1860s, but it really looks a little bit earlier than that in my mind.
I know the costume designer went to the House of Worth.
Oh, interesting.
At least for some of Manuela's dresses. So that was definitely a heavy influence there, that sort of time period.
Cool. Yeah, they're beautiful, but I was like, these are not what I consider golden age of piracy.
They're not 18th century.
No. And then the trances Serafin Gene Kelly keeps putting everyone in, he keeps referencing Mesmer, which is Franz Mesmer, who was an 18th, early 19th century scientist, shall we call him? Doctor, who pioneered animal magnetism. And it kind of did become, I mean, his last name, Mesmer, is where we get the word mesmerized or mesmerism. And so it, like, there is that connection with hypnosis, but he didn't exactly purport to hypnotize people the way that this film does hypnosis. And also, all of his cures were proven to be bunk, and people who studied him in his lifetime were credited with discovering the placebo effect through studying his stuff. So the fact that Gene Kelly is so good at putting in people in trances that one guy never came out of his trance was funny to me. And also I was like, so 1815 is when Mesmer dies. Okay. Commissioner was friends with Mesmer? I guess.
What is time?
What is time? But I think in general, the lack of any consistent year or even decade for this film wasn't really a problem, because that didn't seem to be what the film was about.
Yeah, I mean, we talked about it on the Schmigadoon episode. Mm-hmm. Plug. Go to the back episodes of Historical Friction to catch up now. But this is what Hollywood musicals of the time were all about, were they were typically set in a place that wasn't here, that wasn't now, but they weren't really interested in defining the parameters of what that was. So it would be this sort of vague sense of, this is set at some point in the past, we're going to put some old-timey markers in there to kind of give you an idea, but we're not going to be historically accurate. We mostly just want to make this feel like a fantasy, maybe without tipping over into actual fantasy, though obviously many of them do, like this one. But the historical component of these is really just to give it a vibe, an old-timey vibe that puts it somewhere that is not the current time that it's being filmed in. So yeah, we could take any musical from this time and kind of make a list of all the historical inaccuracies about it, because they all have them. But somehow it doesn't matter in the end that we get this sort of rosy-colored view of a period of time in history through these.
Yeah, and I think this film, it was a film that was about the central love story and about the romance of pirates and also the romance of travel and of a young girl who's feeling confined and constrained in her town, which honestly, there was a lot of Beauty and the Beast Belle vibes there. Like, I think that story is one that's still being told pretty regularly in our culture. It almost struck me how modern in a way some of the dialogue felt. Like, it was real relatable in maybe a disappointing
way. It's absolutely ahead of its time with that. It's why I recommend this to so many people who think that they don't like old movies, because it feels very modern in what it's saying in what it's dealing with, in the jokes that are being told, in the way people are talking. It doesn't feel necessarily like a product of the 1940s. It feels like something that could come out today as a satirical film.
Yes, absolutely. I thought Manuela's character, particularly when she does not like Gene Kelly's character. So when they first meet, they are by the sea, and she's just excited to see the Caribbean for the Makoko of it all. And he follows her up these stairs, and she kind of notices him following her and ends up like trying to like go back down the stairs, but he keeps following. So then she turns around and goes back up the stairs, and he keeps following. And I was like, frankly, this would terrify me today. Like, I would be like, this man is
such a pest. Yeah, it was kind of way.
I was like, oh, this is horrible. There's some stuff that probably in the Me Too era we would say is a little over the top and a little bit like victim blamey. But there's a moment where he says something like, she's like, go away, basically. And he says something like, oh, but I've been provoked. And she says, very well, I shall remove the provocation. And she starts to walk away. I just thought it was hilarious. It was great.
Yeah, I think the performances do a lot to alleviate some of the things that could be kind of icky in this. But everything is so broad. It's so ridiculous. They're having so much fun with it that you're not really taking these things seriously.
No.
It's also a typical arc of a Gene Kelly character to kind of start off as this very brash, braggadocio, confident guy who is very clearly hiding a softer inner person within that. You know, you can kind of tell that this is all an act at the beginning, and as the movie continues on, through the use of song and dance, he's going to get into this position where he can be a receptive lover to his female partner by the end, and a better person.
Yeah, it is very similar character arc-wise to Don Lockwood in Singing in the Rain.
Yes.
It's basically the exact same.
It's basically every character he ever plays.
I have not seen enough Gene Kelly films, I'm sorry to admit, because I know you've seen like all of them.
That's okay. There's time.
I mean, he's so attractive. I think that's the main thing. Not just like physically, though physically. But his whole persona within these is, it's so endearing. Particularly his first song is Seraphin. It's called Niñas. And it's all about how like every girl he sees, he wants to be with. And he's sort of flirting, going through the town, flirting with every single girl. And most of them are welcoming it and don't even seem that offended when he goes on to the next girl. And I was like, this song should really annoy me, but I love it.
But it's a delight. Part of it is that he's putting himself on display in that song, whereas usually, you know, in musical numbers, it's the woman who's on display. We're gawking at, we're sexualizing. Here, he's putting himself literally on display. He pole dances for part of this number. He invites everyone to look at him in his very tight trousers.
Yeah.
So it's sort of turning on its head what we might expect from a musical, that he is very gleefully making himself, even though he's singing about romancing every single woman he meets, the fact that he doesn't learn any woman's name, he just calls everyone Niña. It works because he is very, very kindly putting himself on display for all of us to enjoy and watch. And not only us, the audience, he makes the people of the town his audience. He like makes his own makeshift stage to get all of the attention onto him.
Yeah, that's a really good point, that the film in general, I mean, I wouldn't say it necessarily has a quote unquote female gaze, but it doesn't seem to have a male gaze either. Like, Judy Garland is beautiful all the time and everything she's in, but none of her costuming is particularly male gaze-y. She's beautiful, but the real star of this film and the person that you are there to watch is Gene Kelly, and he definitely gets the tighter trousers. And in what I assume is your favorite scene, the Dream Ballet, he is wearing what my thought when I first watched it was, looks like what you would go to a cheap Halloween costume store and buy if you wanted to get a sexy Wesley costume from Princess Bride. It's it's these incredibly short shorts that are black with like essentially a black sleeveless vest and then like a little like piratey looking head cap. And you can see all of those thighs.
Bless those thighs. Bless those Gene Kelly thighs. Yeah, he based that outfit. That's his big Douglas Fairbanks influence there, is that he takes the Douglas Fairbanks pirate look and then he turns it into this incredibly campy dance outfit that just feels like he's going to burst out of it at any second. It's so tight. It's so ridiculous. That was a really purposeful thing for him. This is the most that, you know, he's exposed skin-wise in any of his films. And we thank him for that. But he was very much aware of what his body looked like on screen and how to make it appealing in terms of dance. So he would have the trousers of his costumes taken in at the waist and hips specifically to emphasize his posterior in every single thing that he did. That was an active decision that Gene Kelly would make in all of his films.
It's beautiful. It also, honestly, besides that being like a thirst trap, does really show what a talented dancer he is. Like, you can definitely appreciate the physicality of the dance and the nuance of the dance and everything, whether it's the incredibly tight short shorts or actual trousers. He's a fantastic dancer.
I think he's pretty good.
Yeah. Tell us about the Dream Ballet.
Oh my goodness. The Dream Ballet is just a work of art. Dream ballets are admittedly my favorite thing in the world. It's what I did half of my PhD on, so I get very excited when they are in movies, and I know not everyone loves them. I feel like everyone would love this one, though. It's not too long. It's about two minutes in length, maybe, yeah. Tops. And it is just bonkers from start to finish. It is just the most over-the-top, exaggerated display of masculinity encapsulated through fantasy dance that you can imagine.
But not toxic masculinity.
No. It's camp masculinity from start to finish. It comes at a point in the film where Serafin has just revealed to Manuela that he is Makoko, even though he isn't, and is trying to put on this display for her. So he goes outside and starts fighting off guards who are standing outside, pretending that he's this dread pirate and not this traveling actor. So he's putting on a show for her outside of her window, and she's looking down on him, trying to make sense of what she's just found out, that this silly actor is the person that she's been fantasizing about for her entire life. And that's when she kind of goes into this fantasy of trying to make this silly figure in front of her into what she had been dreaming of. So the dream is really just her desires amplified to the 100th degree. So it is sort of an idea of masculinity exaggerated to ridiculous standards. So we talked about his costume already, which is just very revealing and shows everything that she might want to see there. But the entire dance is just Gene Kelly running about, leaping through the air, twirling swords, and has huge explosions in the background, and he's fighting other pirates, and he's just a grotesque but amazing exaggeration of what a sheltered young woman's idea of masculinity might be. Mm-hmm. It's all of her desires run rampant in a 2-minute segment.
In which, once again, we're sort of treated to the female gaze as she looks at Gene Kelly becoming the pirate of her dreams.
Yeah. In the song that she sings beforehand, when she's singing about her desire of Makoko, she sings that Makoko leaves a flaming trail of masculinity, which then I feel like it's perfect for then describing what she imagines in the Dream Ballet in every sense of all of those words. It is a flaming trail of masculinity in that 2-minute section.
Yes, that is maybe the best description of that Dream Ballet.
It's perfect. Thank you, Cole Porter.
Yeah, again though, camp masculinity, not like what masculinity is seeming to become in a 21st century kind of toxic way, but just in like the beautifulness of it.
The whole film is just a camp classic, and that's why it's lovely, is that everything it deals with any kind of a tongue-in-cheek, over-the-top, exaggerated, artificial way.
I think that what really, for me, sort of made it was how, I mean, this sounds sort of a little bit cliche, but how like feisty Manuela was with Seraphine / Makoko, and how it wasn't just about sort of surrendering to this pirate and in a swoony ingenue way. Even after she believes that he is Makoko, when he asks for her and the townspeople come to her door while she's supposedly barricaded herself in, and the townsmen are standing outside her door going, "Manuela, he's asked for you, and if you don't go, he's going to put the whole town to flame. Think of our wives and our children. You must go." And they don't actually show her. They just show the men standing outside her door, and you hear Judy Garland yelling out, "No, I can't do this. Don't ask this of me." And they're like, "No, please, you must go." And she's like, "How could you even ask this? This will ruin my whole life." And they're like, "We know it will, but think of your sacrifice." And she's like, "No, no." And then it cuts to her in her bedroom, and she's like putting on makeup and perfume and like primping for going over to Makoko. And then when she's like walking over there, everyone in the town is very like somberly watching her go to bravely sacrifice herself to this pirate. And this other girl runs up to her and is like, "Oh, Manuela, like your whole life's ahead of you. You're supposed to marry Don Pedro. I'll go, I'll go." And she just stops and
I volunteer as tribute.
Yeah, basically. And she stops and she looks at the girl and she's like, "He asked for me." And you're like, excellent. Amazing.
It's fantastic. That's one of my favorite moments in the film, because it's just, it's so funny. Judy Garland is so funny. She just absolutely knows what she's doing. And again, it's that focus on female desire there that's just so delicious to look. It also is one of my favorite things in old Hollywood films, because if you look at the production code administration memos about this. So the Production Code Administration was basically the censorship board for film at this time. In Hollywood, you'd have to submit your film, the script for your film, to the board. A bunch of people would read it over and find all of the naughty bits that they would take offense to, and then they would send a memo back and say, "Here are the things that we find offensive, please take them out." Usually there's a back and forth, but you needed the stamp of the approval from the Production Code Administration to be able to release your film into theaters. They wouldn't carry it without that. But one of my favorite things about films at this time is that a lot of times the production code will say, "Oh, you must take this out. No." And then the studio just goes ahead with it and doesn't make the cut at all. And this scene in particular is one that the production code came back and said, "Absolutely not," clutching their pearls at it. They said in their memo, "We must ask that Seraphine definitize the purpose for which he wants Manuela brought to him. This is in order to avoid the inescapable suggestion that the people around town have in mind that the girl is going to sacrifice her virtue. In this connection, on page 70, we question the wording sacrifice of a young girl and ask that the fear of the advocate and the people be definitely expressed in order to get away from any intimation that they think she is going to sacrifice her virtue." Of course, they don't change anything after that, but they tried to get that censored. They tried to, you know, not have that suggestion in there. And MGM was just like, "No. We'll get away with it. We'll keep it in."
That's wonderful. Wow.
It's fantastic.
I think what I also really liked is right after that moment, so she gets to his house to not sacrifice her virtue. No.
Don't even suggest it.
Don't suggest that. No, but she gets to his house, and that's when one of the other troupe members says something like, "Oh, well, when you were in the trance at our show last week, you were singing about how great Makoko was." And then she like puts together that Seraphine is pretending to be Makoko because of her song that she can't remember from when she was in her trance. And instead of like just getting mad at him about it, she starts to sort of play him, like pretending that he's the pirate, which I thought was so great when she goes out to see him and he's pretending he's Makoko. And she's like, how could have I been so gullible? And he's like, huh? And she's like, I should have known from the moment I saw you that you were a pirate and that you knew nothing about acting. And then he starts sort of defending his acting to her, which is very funny. And honestly, kind of mirrors what happens with Don Pedro at the end, where instead of nagging his acting, she starts going on and on about how great pirates are, but to Gene Kelly as Seraphine / Makoko. And so Don Pedro, the real Makoko, has to go in and defend his piracy. It's really just male ego at that point.
It's excellent.
If he'd just shut up for long enough, they would have hanged Gene Kelly.
It's true. Thankfully, that didn't happen.
Thankfully, no. But yeah, every time I saw Don Pedro, my mind just went to What We Do in the Shadows, and I wanted him to just go bat and like turn into a bat like Matt Berry does in that show. So I was hoping.
It's all I'm going to see every time I watch it from now
on. You will. He'll walk in and just go bat in your mind, and it's going to be great for you. So at the end of the film, when she is pretending that he is the pirate and he's putting on his last quote unquote show where he's going to try to put Don Pedro into a trance, he ends up doing a song and dance number first with that show. And he's doing that with the Nicholas brothers. And I think this is actually a pretty important moment. And Lisa, if you want to talk about that.
Yeah, it's a great moment in the film. Obviously, at the time that this is being made, Hollywood is an extremely racist place to be. Everything is incredibly segregated at this time. Again, it's 1948 in America. And so there weren't a lot of opportunities for Black people to be on screen at all, really. There was, again, a lot had to do with the production code, a lot had to do with state laws in terms of what roles Black people were allowed to play in films, people of color in general, but Black people especially. And so in this film, it's sort of, you know, it's a complicated thing to look at. It's set in the Caribbean, but you have an entirely white cast. And it's tricky because a lot of this is done because of rules in place, because of how Hollywood was formed at the time. Minnelli, as a director, you know, really fought for inclusion in his films. Very first film that he ever directed was Cabin in the Sky at MGM, which is an all-Black cast musical. This was something that was really important to him. And so we do actually get, you know, a lot of background actors, background characters that are Black, which is, you know, not great. They're kind of just set dressing, but also with another director at another studio, it very likely could have been white people in blackface playing those roles, or just not even having anyone at all and just, you know, having entirely white people in the background as well. So there's complications going on with race within this film. And that kind of comes to a head with the Nicholas Brothers routine. The Nicholas Brothers were sort of the most revered dancers at this time. Both Gene Kelly and Fred Astaire named them as the greatest dancers. They're really, really respected. But because they were Black, they didn't really have the opportunities in Hollywood. They couldn't star in their own film. They were always relegated to what were called specialty numbers, which is what they do in this film. So they just kind of appear out of nowhere, they dance one number, and then they disappear again. They don't have characters. They're not really playing anybody. They're just there to do a number. And this was common in lots of musicals at the time, is that they would get Black performers to come in to just sing a number or dance a number. They wouldn't have anything to do with the plot, and then they would disappear. And this was because of censorship laws in the South, in the Southern United States, where they would not screen a film with Black people in it. They would flat out refuse to show a movie with any sort of prominent depictions of Black people. And so what studios would do with musicals is they would put these performers in these numbers that they could then cut out for distribution in Southern cinemas. So they would have to make them in a way where they could remove these sections and have it not affect the whole of the film. And so Gene Kelly went to MGM and really wanted the Nicholas Brothers because he wanted to work with them in this film. And MGM said, no, that's going to cost us a lot of money because we're going to have to cut them out. They're not going to show it in the South if we put them in. But he really, really pressed it. He was finally successful in getting them to come in and do a number with him. But MGM was right. The Southern Cinemas would not show it with this number in it. And so they literally had to cut this number out of the prints that they sent to the South for it to be able to be screened, which is a real shame that then audiences were deprived of this fantastic acrobatic number.
So what you're saying is maybe we shouldn't let states individually decide certain things? Is that...
I don't know. What? Did I say that?
Interesting. Yeah. No, I did notice within the film that there were actually some Black actors as extras in the crowd scenes, and I was honestly surprised by it. So what you're saying about Minnelli as a director is interesting, because I did not know that about him and his history with casting in his films. But I was surprised. I was like, I assumed that it would be a pretty white Caribbean because of the year. But even early on, like in the first scene where we're being introduced to Serafin and there's a huge crowd on the pier, I was surprised because there were actually Black people within the crowd. And there are, I don't know if it was the Nicholas Brothers, but sort of in the background with his troupe. And you can't see anybody in his troupe very clearly, but it looked like he might have had a few Black actors in the troupe as well. And I was like, this is, this feels horribly, this feels very progressive for 1948. Like
it's a hard thing of being like, yeah, it's not great because everyone is sort of just set dressing, but it is not the norm of the Hollywood films of the time. When MGM purchased the rights to it, because this started as... It was a novel, and then it was adapted to a Broadway stage show, and then MGM got the rights for the stage show, and it went through a whole bunch of rewrites at MGM. But the first script that they had submitted for this, they had Lena Horne attached to play a supporting role. And actually, when they first acquire this, she's the only actor that they name as like, oh, we're going to bring Lena Horne in for a supporting part when we turn this into a musical. It was bought. It was going to be a straight movie. But the first memo listed Cary Grant and Ingrid Bergman as the stars they wanted in this. So that was the direction they were going with it. But as soon as they decided for it to be a musical, the only named person they had in the memo was, we'll find a part for Lena Horne in this. So she was involved for a lot of the production process, but eventually got cut from the film, unfortunately. But yeah, there's a lot of Minnelli trying to work with not just people who are white and not often succeeding, unfortunately.
Yeah, that is disappointing. It feels like since they did go ahead and have the Nicholas Brothers, they should have just said, screw the Southern States, put Lena Horne in and made a really good film, like incomparably good.
Wouldn't that be great? Yeah.
But yeah, what you were saying too about the ability to sort of easily cut out the scenes with Black dancers and actors to show it in these states that restricted the casts of the films they were showing. Sounds like honestly what huge film studios today are doing with capitulating to like Chinese markets and being able to easily cut out any reference to somebody being queer, or if there's like a moment where two people of the same sex kiss or something like that, it has to be in such a way that it doesn't affect the plot too much, because we want to be able to cut out those 6 seconds or those 2 lines so that we can open it in markets that are lucrative but are not going to be receptive, which is upsetting. And it kind of, given the way that Hollywood then and now is, I mean, all we say is representation matters, representation matters. It kind of feels like maybe they should just be brave enough to do some representation. I don't know. Just
It's almost like there is systemic racism everywhere, and that's preventing them from actually wanting to make money.
Yeah. And systemic anti-queerness that just continues to proliferate. Yeah, that is those parallels and how we like to think, oh, we've come so far. And then when you think about it, you're like, maybe actually the same things are happening, but just in different, they're coming out in different markets and in different ways now and with different forms of oppression. Not that like non-white representation is great in Hollywood. It's certainly better than it was in 1948.
Which is a very low bar to clear.
but there are still lots of issues around representation and who is cast in roles and why based on race and sexual orientation and gender identity.
All of that.
Wow. So this got depressing all of a sudden, but this is a really fun film. So why don't we get back to some of the fun stuff so that we don't end on like a really depressing note? Yeah. One of the things that I wanted to point out was that the way that Judy Garland, Manuela, realizes that Don Pedro is actually Makoko, because even though she knows that Gene Kelly isn't, she does not yet know that Don Pedro is. And Don Pedro has managed to fill Serafin's acting trunks with his Makoko treasure. And so when Serafin, Gene Kelly's like, no, like you can look in my trunks. I'm not actually a pirate, guys. These are just like costumes and crap. And they open the trunk and it is all of this pirate treasure. And she's looking at it. And so at the very beginning, when they got engaged, Don Pedro gave Manuela a ring. And I had never seen this film. So I'm just like writing down notes as I go. And my note on the ring, when they like show the ring on her finger, I wrote, that ring is ugly as hell. It's like, it's like silver cat vomit with jade bits of kibble in it. And
accurate.
And so I was like, I don't know why the hell they would choose that ugly ass ring for this film, but whatever. I guess if she thinks it's pretty. But anyway, so then we cut to the end where she's looking in the pirate treasure chest and she finds like this belt kind of thing. And it is the exact same pattern as her ring. So clearly her ring had been like forged from this belt thing. So she realizes that this Makoko's treasure was Don Pedro's and that he must be Makoko. And I just had this moment where I was like, thank God that ugly ass ring had a purpose because it's so bad.
It was foreshadowing.
Yes. What's a funny moment for you?
Oh my gosh. The entire film is so good. Everything's amazing about it. I mean, we've talked about my favorite one, which is her putting on the vestiges of propriety to then go sacrifice her virginity to a pirate that she had been fantasizing about openly the entire film, literally thirsting after. The film starts with her just regaling her friends with the thirstiness that she has and all of her friends being like, what is wrong with this person? What? Wonderful. Fantastic. I think everyone is just so campy and fun and over the top. Audiences didn't love it at the time because they didn't know what was good for them in 1948, apparently, but it did not do well in the way that a MGM musical directed by Vincent Minnelli starring Gene Kelly and Judy Garland should have done in the box office. Audiences did not get it because it is ahead of its time.
Yeah.
Critics liked it though. And I would say from a couple of the reviews of the time of this film, I really like the Los Angeles Herald Express's thinking of it. They said, if the millennium ever comes, which is just like a really dire way to start a review, like, you know, if we're still here in 50 years, they say, if the millennium ever comes, no Hollywood musicals will have formula plots. In the meanwhile, pictures like The Pirate rate hearty cheers as paving the way, which I really like because number one, they assume that the musical is going to be this dominant form still 50, 100 years later. And spoiler, it's not. but the fact they recognize that, you know, there's formula plots happening at that time, but that the pirate is breaking the mold of this. The pirate is not like any other musical that's being made at this time. And then I'll just share that the Hollywood Reporter has two of my favorite lines from a review. The Hollywood Reporter talks about the pirate as, the simplest way to describe the pirate is wow! Exclamation point. Which I think is like, yes, that's all you need to know. That is 100% correct. It's just wow. So you should see it. And then they describe Gene Kelly in the most perfect way. They say, Gene Kelly has the part of his career as the Casanova with ham in his heart and romance on his lips. Delightful. Perfect. No notes.
That's a beautiful review. I feel like the wow is basically what I texted you.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. It's everyone's a bit like, oh, what is this? Wow.
Wow.
What am I watching now?
Indeed. Oh, before we go, I do have to tell you my favorite line, which is at the end, right after she realizes with the ugly ass ring that Don Pedro is Makoko, she starts leaving. She'd sort of been on this stage thing, and she starts coming down the stairs in her fake trance. And Don Pedro like jumps up and he's like, no, no, we're putting a stop to this. Wake her up, wake her up. Well, and first of all, the commissioner says, if you wake her up, you'll kill her, which I don't know why they think that would happen, that if you wake up out of a hypnotic trance.
Like, it's a common sleepwalker trope, yeah. That like if you wake a sleepwalker, they're gonna die.
But anyway, no, that's not my favorite line. So then Don Pedro keeps trying to say, no, we can't have this happen. And the commissioner says, no, we're going to see this. And he says, I don't want you to ruin my enjoyment with your bourgeois possessiveness. And I was like, that's the best. I'm just gonna say that to everybody now. Like, I do not want you ruining my enjoyment with bourgeois possessiveness.
It works in so many situations.
It does. Just like, I loved it. I also was really not expecting that line in a 1948 film. It was great. Oh, and in the very last scene, when Judy Garland and Gene Kelly are doing the reprise of Be a Clown, which is basically Make 'em Laugh from Singing in the Rain.
Well, Make 'em Laugh is Be a Clown, to be clear.
Okay, fair. That's true. That came later.
Arthur Freed stole from Cole Porter.
But yes, they're doing the reprise of Be a Clown, which is the dance that he had done with the Nicholas Brothers earlier. But they do this like zoom in thing where they like have their ears wiggle in it. And I don't know how they did that.
It's Hollywood magic.
I was like, this is the best special effect in the whole thing.
Clearly we're not watching the Blu-ray disc version, which just came out a few months ago, where you can see the fishing line. Oh, that is,
it's too bad.
They weren't that talented.
No, I was watching a standard definition
version. Oh, not the way to do it.
Sorry.
Everyone buy the Blu-ray.
Yeah, you got to drive the Blu-ray sales, don't you?
Plug. I've been asking for it forever and they finally made it, so everyone should buy it.
Yeah, even if you can see the fishing wire, it's worth it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. I think that we are getting near the end of our discussion. Did you have any notes or anything that you wanted to talk about?
I mean, I could genuinely talk about this movie for like 3 more hours. Easily.
Well, tell us some more.
No. I think we covered all of the main beats of it. I just hope we've enticed people to watch it because it is a delight. If you're looking for, you know, a way to escape for an hour and a half, it's not a huge time commitment.
No, it's not.
You're going to love it. I guarantee this. I guarantee you will be delighted by the visuals and the story and the dancing and the music and just the campness of it all. It's wonderful. It's a delight.
Awesome. Well, on that note, everybody go watch The Pirate. And until next time, big slay. Thanks so much for listening. And as always, you can find our podcast on Twitter at History Friction, and you can find Lisa on Twitter at _Lisa with an S. We hope you enjoyed this episode, the first in our Historical Friction Pirate season. We have more episodes about pirates and film and literature coming up in the next few weeks that we can't wait to share with you. See you soon!